We're going to be in Proverbs today.
Proverbs!
There are blue Bibles, like the one I just grabbed on the ends of the rows. You can grab one if you would like. Proverbs, the beginning of Proverbs is actually page 438 in these blue Bibles. That's the public service announcement. The Bible isn't a soloist. The Bible isn't a soloist. It's not singing with just one voice. Growing up as a part of the church like I did, a lot of times I got the impression when people took the Bible that every book in the Bible is speaking or singing with the exact same voice and that it should be read in exactly the same, way. But the older that I've gotten, and as I've really tried to take the Bible seriously and following Jesus seriously myself, and begun actually like reading the Bible and listening to the Bible and trying to like really take seriously the witness of the Bible, I've realized that the Bible doesn't make any sense as a soloist. It's not a soloist. It doesn't make sense on a very practical level. If you just want to, on a practical level of like when how we read the Bible, how we understand, how we actually read it. You know, the different books of the Bible here and there. They all sound different, and they all reflect different parts of history. And it doesn't make sense when we actually start trying to hear all of this as like a soloist singing with one voice. Because between the covers of this book, right here, we've got the story, we got the story of a left-handed assassin who kills a morbidly obese king, right here on this page. And then we've got instructions on how to handle psoriasis, ancient instructions on how to handle psoriasis, right here on this page. And then we've got incredibly long genealogies of people that we've never even heard of, like throughout. And then we've got a first century correspondence of the earliest Christian communities. What do we make of all this? And then we've got the Proverbs that we're going to be looking at today. How are we to understand the shape of this forest when we've got all these crazy trees in front of us, you know? Like, how do we get a sense of the shape of the forest? The older I've gotten, the more I've realized that as I've tried to take the Bible seriously, that the Bible's a lot less like a soloist and more like a choir. This is a library of ancient texts that are all different voices. And they're all singing different parts. Not all of the voices sound the same. They're not all singing the same notes. They're not all singing at the same time. Some of the voices are singing tenor. Some are singing soprano. Some are punching parts of the song that, you know, really hard at only certain moments. And then others are softly carrying the theme and the melody through the whole thing. But they're not all just one voice. So let's just say that, because we're shifting gears right now from Mark to Proverbs. These voices sound differently, but they're all part of the same choir. They're all singing the same song. As Christians, we would say that they're all singing the song of the glory of God. That's ultimately the song they're singing. They're singing about how majestic and wonderful and glorious and good God is. How God creates the world and rescues the world and shares his limitless life and love and joy with the world. That's the song they're all singing as a choir. That's the song they're all singing. That's the story that the Bible's telling. That's the song that they're singing. But we're shifting gears, because over the summer we've been in Mark. The last little bit we've been in Mark. And that's one of the voices in the choir that we can hear very, very clearly. We can hear the main themes of this song kind of throughout the story of Mark. We were following God in the flesh around and watching what the world looks like when things are as he wants them to be. The next 8 weeks or so, we're not going to be legalistic about it. We might go longer, I don't know. But over the next little bit, we're going to be in the Proverbs. And that's a different voice. This sounds different. This is singing a different part in the choir. So I just wanted to say that. It is different. It sounds different, and that's because the Bible has got a lot of different voices in it. So let's go ahead and start the book of Proverbs. Everybody there? Yeah? Am I alone in this room? No, I'm not. Okay, here we go. Proverbs 1, starting in verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning. Let the discerning get guidance for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's enough for us to go on this morning. That's plenty. There's this scene at the end. I've only seen the movie once, so someone will have to correct me if I don't remember this correctly. But there's this scene at the end of National Treasure. You guys have seen National Treasure. Nicolas Cage, you know, Declaration of Independence, stealing us, something like that. Constitution, I don't know what he's doing. But Nicolas Cage, at the end of this movie, Nicolas Cage and company, John Voight. Why is John Voight with him? But John Voight and Nicolas Cage and company, at the end of the movie, find themselves in a massive treasure chamber. This made an impression on me when I saw the movie. They find that they, like, light something, and all of a sudden light starts spreading, and the chamber is massive. It's gargantuan. It's just as far as the eye can see. It's gold and artifacts and statues and treasure, treasure, treasure. I mean, it's just as far as the eye can see. I got that right, didn't I? Yeah. Okay. Well, I was making sure. Making sure it wasn't DuckTales or something, the money bin. So I think that might be something of the way that we should be feeling when we approach the book of Proverbs. As we open the book of Proverbs, this really is the riches and wisdom of Israel's third king, King Solomon. The riches and wisdom of this guy are legendary. They're the stuff of legend. I mean, really. I mean, it's just like you start reading ancient literature and all kinds of people were thinking about this guy, his riches and his wisdom. And here we have a treasure chamber opening vast before us, a treasure chamber of wisdom, open wide before us. Nobody really knows how much of this book, some of this book goes back to Solomon, but nobody really knows how much of it goes back to Solomon, and how much of it was like later collected by the community of Israel and christened in his name. You know what I mean? That like, what's absolutely certain is Solomon didn't sit down one day and just write the book of Proverbs from beginning to end. What kind of freak, OCD freak, would he be to be able to write down all of this? I mean, and I say that because when you read the book itself, there are scenes throughout the book. There are places in the book where it says, now here are some of the sayings of Solomon, and now here are some things that a guy named Agur said, and here are some of the sayings of King Lemuel. I don't know. The secret of Bible names is you just say them like you know what you're saying, and nobody questions it. Lemuel. Here are some of the but like throughout the book, it's like saying Solomon, Agur, Lemuel. At one point in chapter 24, it actually just says in verse 23, it actually says, here are some things that wise people say. You know, it's not even trying to like credit it to anybody. And there are plenty of parts of the book of Proverbs where there's like poetry and art and writing that like are just, they seem to be completely anonymous. But the opening verse here of Proverbs seems to be saying that this treasure chamber opening before us, it captures what was best and wisest in Israel. This is the best and wisest of the people of God. The Proverbs of Solomon. I mean, I don't know how else you can say it more strongly. Just a heads up, the first 9 chapters of Proverbs are actually just like one giant poem. So if you're looking for Proverbs at the beginning of Proverbs, you're going to be disappointed. It's just one big, long poem, the book of Proverbs. We'll probably be looking a little bit at that next week. Inviting people Come in to this treasure chamber. Look around. Look around, touch things, take them for your own. Whatever you do, do not leave this treasure chamber without finding wisdom. Don't just admire what's here. Take it for your own. And then in chapter 10, I don't know if you guys are flipping around, but chapter 10 is actually where the Proverbs begin in earnest, where the Proverbs begin. And we all know what a proverb is, right? We're all familiar. A proverb's like a practical truth. It's a practical truth that gets loaded into a short saying. It's a practical truth that gets loaded into like a short saying. In scripture, there are like the proverbs that we actually have. A lot of times they're like micro poems. They're like little micro poems. They're artistic little riddles. To use the language of verse 6 right here. They're artistic little riddles that they just unfold more and more truth the longer you sit with them, the longer you explore them. But they can also just like be popular sayings. They can also just be popular sayings, you know, that memorable ways of expressing truth. We still use these today. You may have used it this week. You may have used a proverb this week. Imagine parenting a child for a second. Some of you, that's not your imagination. Some of you are like, I don't have to imagine, I'm doing it. That's my life. Imagine parenting a child for a second, and imagine you're wanting your child to know something. They're struggling to do something. It's something hard. It's something frustrating. Then they're getting discouraged, and you want them to know something. You want them to know that there are things more important than this thing that they're struggling with right now. There are things more important than that. And so you say to them, my child, the way that we conduct ourselves and the kind of people that we're being formed into, that's often far more important than the results that we get. So take heart. Well, that might be true. I think that is true, but that's not very memorable, right? I mean, it's far more important, the process right now is far more important. But when I say, it's not whether you win or lose. Someone knows it. So, thank you. I am not alone in this room. It's not whether you win or lose. It's how you play the game. All of a sudden, we got a proverb. All of a sudden, it's a practical, popular truth that's been packaged in a memorable way. Somehow, it's caught on among us. That's what the proverbs are. They're like loaded down with truth. And that expression, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. That's actually a fantastic example of a proverb. It really is. Because it's also something that we've heard so often. We've heard it so often. It's such a popular rendering of a particular truth that it's really easy to despise it a little. It's really easy to be like, I hate that, you know? It's easy to say, I've heard that 1,000 times. I know already what that means. But not really be captured by this truth, nor by the depth and the reality of this truth. If I say, oh, I know what that means, it's not whether you win or lose, I know already what that means, but then I spend, which I do during the week, I spend untold, ungodly amounts of energy obsessing over the outcomes of particular situations rather than doing my best and living with integrity, I might know what that saying means, but I don't really know what that saying means. Are you following me? You know on some level, some truth, some wisdom, you know it, but then it's another thing to really know it, to really know it in the depths of our being, to live our lives in alignment with a certain truth, to live in rhythm with it, to live in the reality of it. That's a different sort of thing. I think that deeper kind of knowing is what the Proverbs are inviting us into. That's what the Proverbs are inviting us into. This is a treasure chamber before us, inviting us to, it tells us what it's inviting us into right here at the beginning. It's inviting us into, Let me flip back to it. Verse 2, it's inviting us into to become people of insight, to be able to like see beyond just the surface of things. You know, we live our lives and we see the surface of things. It's inviting us to have a deeper kind of knowing that leads to a deeper kind of vision. Like, I can see the world. I can really see what's going on. And I can understand the world and my life and the people around me in a new and a deeper and a truer sort of way. And they're inviting us into, good grief, the fan keeps blowing my paper, my pages. Verse 3, it's inviting us into like a better way of living, into a different way of behaving, which sounds like micromanaging moralistic little behavior, but it really is. He's inviting us into a better way of being human, into a better way of living life, where we do what is right, verse 3, and just and fair. That's what we're invited into right now and what I want to be exploring the next few weeks. I want to be exploring what does it mean to get better at the art of human life? What does it mean? Because I think that's what the Proverbs are inviting us into. What does it look like to become more skilled, better at living life? What's it look like to be better at the art of human life? That's what we're invited into when we say wisdom. When we say wisdom, we're invited into wisdom. That's what we're talking about. And it's a little different than we would expect, because we hear the word wisdom and it sounds like smartsy, artsy sorts of stuff. It sounds like people with a high IQ and like who push their glasses back like this and, have a certain level of genius. Those are the people with wisdom. But verse 4 is inviting, this is for everyone. This is inviting the simple into this, the young into this, and even verse 5, the wisest among us, the people who are wisest among us, can still be learning what it means to be better at the art of human life. And then verse 7 plunges us into the Proverbs. It like, welcome to the treasure chamber, welcome to the Proverbs, and it starts us off with the most interesting of riddles, the most interesting of proverbs is how we begin. And so I want to chew on this one. I want to wrestle with this one just a little bit as we're moving to the table this morning. Sound like a plan? Okay. Verse 7 is the very first proverb of the book of Proverbs. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's the first proverb. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Rabbis and scholars and teachers over the centuries, they've said that the way that you really begin to understand the Proverbs, the way that you really is that word that I used just a second ago, you gotta chew on them. You gotta chew on them for a while, because Proverbs can sound like the stupidest of sayings, the tritest of truisms. They can sound so stupid if you just read proverb after proverb after proverb. If you're just kind of going through and reading them, trying to read through the book of Proverbs in one sitting, don't do it. Oh man, it's bad. It's hard. But if you take one of them, and you put it in your mouth, you start chewing on it for a while and begin wrestling with it and reflecting on it, you may begin to start tasting its truth. You may begin to start tasting the subtleties and the layers and the depth of truth that's been folded up into this little micro poem, into this little popular saying. You gotta let them sit in your mouth for a while. You gotta let them like a lozenge. Or like a menthol cough drop or something. You gotta let it just sit in your mouth for a while, but then eventually you begin to absorb the wisdom. You begin to start realizing it and tasting it. Over the coming weeks, I want to practice that. I want to practice that with some of the proverbs. But let's do a little bit of that here right now. Let's chew on this one for a second. For most of us, as we look at this proverb, I think there's one word that jumps out in this proverb. You can guess what it is. It's the word that jumps out to you, too. It's the word fear. That's the word that jumps out to us when we read this proverb. Most of us, most of our lives, are spent trying to avoid fear, right? I mean, we rig up our houses with intricate security systems so that we can have a fearless night's sleep. We take medications. We take medications so that we can get rid of any kind of low-grade anxiety or fear that we might be feeling and experiencing during the week. We generally avoid going into dark rooms filled with spiders and snakes. I mean, that's the way we live most of our lives. We avoid fear if we can. We don't like fear. Good grief. We do everything we can to avoid it. But this is a little strange, I think, for this treasure chamber, one of the books of wisdom of the Bible, to begin with a proverb like this. That there's a deeper and truer way for us to live. I'm signing up for that. I'd like that. A deeper, truer way to see the world and to live my life. I'll sign up for that. But fear? That doesn't sound quite like the right entrance to it, does it? That doesn't quite sound right, like the right way in. So let's just chew on maybe that word for just a second. And then I think that's going to lead us to the table. That little word, yirat. Yirat. I know, if I said yirat, you're not quite familiar with that, what that word means, are you? Fear, you know. Yirat, not as much. Yirat gets translated fear right here, but that is a word that means more than just dread or terror or, I'm trembling because of a dark room full of spiders and snakes. Yirat is a word that conveys reverence and awe and kind of respect. It's like a healthy fear. Most of us know what yirat means instinctively because we all have electrical outlets and a lot of us have natural gas in our house. That's yirat. We know that electrical outlets, that electricity and natural gas are good and powerful. We know that electricity and natural gas are good and powerful, and so we treat them with the awe and the respect and the reverence that they deserve every day. We live in reverence and respect. We don't say it that way, but we live in reverence and respect before the power, the almighty power of electricity and natural gas. We know that there are certain ways of living. There are certain ways of behaving, like being careless with grease on the stovetop or sticking something pointy and metal into an electrical outlet. That would be the path of the fool. That would be the path of the fool, and it would lead to destruction. We all kind of instinctively kind of know this level of yirat. It's a healthy sort of fear. Then when this proverb says that the yirat of yirat Adonai, yirat Yahweh, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, I think it's largely talking in that way. It's largely talking in that way that we, about healthy fear, about awe and reverence and respect, that the beginning of knowledge, the beginning of the good, the deeper, the truer sort of life that we all can live is learning to live with care and respect and reverence before the almighty mystery that is behind the universe. Like, we're all here, and there's something more beyond, above, behind, beneath. There's something else. And living with reverence before that mystery, that is the beginning of knowledge. The beginning of wisdom is to open up all of our lives before this mystery. To open up all of our lives, our thoughts, our emotions, our being, our energy, our attention, our will, every bit of us, and to give it all to God for reevaluation. For reevaluation, for review, for reordering, for change. Notice what this proverb, as we're chewing on it, notice what the contrasting image is in verse 7. The fear of the Lord, the contrasting image of the fear of the Lord is the fool. The fool that should give us a clue as to what the primary meaning right here of the fear of the Lord means. Because the person who wants no instruction, who doesn't want to lay out all of their life before God and have it reordered and reevaluated and changed, that is the person who has no fear of the Lord. That's the contrasting image here. The beginning of wisdom is fear. It's fear. It's reverence. It's fear of the Lord. It isn't just us quaking in terror or dread or something, but it's learning for us to invite instruction. We want to learn to invite. This isn't something I'm good at. I don't think it's any of us are good at it. Inviting instruction in our lives. I'd like for you to, that begs the question, am I doing that? Am I the kind of person who wants instruction in my life? Do I want to be directed? Do I want something bigger than just me to be guiding me? And so as we enter into this treasure chamber over the next few weeks and start looking around, the scripture is inviting us to stand in awe of the grandeur and the glory and the wisdom of God, and then to allow the reality of his presence that is with us every single day, every moment of the day, whether you feel spiritual or not, the reality of his presence, something more grand and more ancient and more lovely than ourselves, to allow that presence to begin reordering our lives. That's the beginning of knowledge. Because that healthy fear, that reverence, that awe, that respect, that's the beginning of wisdom. That's the beginning of knowledge. But there's another thing here too. I don't want to squash this word. I think the primary meaning of it is reverence and awe and respect and like standing in the presence, a healthy fear. I think that's what's going on here. But there is a degree to which this is dread and terror. There's a degree to which this is Yirat is dread and terror. There's no way around it, really. That's what the word means on some level. The quaking in our boots, kind of like fearful. And that makes sense, too, I think, on some level. Turn with me to Luke 12. Luke chapter 12, if you want to. Luke chapter 12. When I begin to imagine the immensity and the reality and the gravity of God himself, of this mystery behind everything, when I begin to imagine, like really try to take it in, the glory and the grandeur and the power of God, the Holy One himself, that's a bit terrifying. That is a bit terrifying. Because, I mean, good grief, I know what kind of darkness I carry around in me. I know what kind of darkness I carry around in me. I know what kind of darkness I contribute to the world. And my darkness has no place in a world filled with light. My corruption has no place in a world full of flourishing. My death has no place in a world filled with life. And that makes me tremble a little bit. That makes me afraid, dread, terror. That is a level to this word. And I think Jesus and Proverbs may be on the same wavelength when they talk about fear. When Jesus says in Luke 12, starting in verse 4, "I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after your body has been killed has authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." Jesus says, I'll give you something to fear. Don't fear the wrong things. Those terrorists, those drunk drivers, those people over there, those gossips. Don't fear them. Everything else in your life, all the fear should melt away. I'll give you something to fear. Fear the right thing. Fear God. I want you to fear God. He's the one with all the power in the universe. He's the one, according to the parallel in Matthew 10, he's the one who has the power to destroy body and soul in Gehenna, in hell. He's the one who can do that. So fear him. Realization. He's inviting all of us to realize our guilt and our darkness before God, our position before God. Yes, I tell you, fear him. And that's the place that I think all of us need to come to. That's a place to start. That's a starting place. That's even that kind of fear of the Lord. Even that's the beginning of wisdom. But it's not the pinnacle of wisdom. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's not the pinnacle of wisdom. And I will preach this until my dying day, because this is the good news of the gospel. That the pinnacle of wisdom. Jesus keeps talking right here in Luke 12. Jesus keeps talking. He says, fear him. Fear him who, after your body has been killed, has authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Verse 6. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. You see, the terror of the Lord might be the beginning of wisdom, but it's not the end of wisdom. It's not the goal of wisdom. It's not the pinnacle of wisdom at all. God's goal in every single one of our lives, the end to which God is always aiming, that he's always wanting us to realize this, is that we would believe him when he says, do not be afraid, you're worth more than some birds. Do not be afraid. God's goal for every single person on this planet is that we would realize the depth of his unflickering, unwavering, unimaginable love for us. And that we would begin to reflect that love into the world. Because if we're loaded up with fear, there's no way that we can reflect love. That's the only way that we can really, truly begin to reflect love is when we know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that you are worth more than some birds. That's God's goal. That's always God's goal, for us to know God's love and then to reflect God's love. That's the goal of wisdom, by the way, as we're beginning Proverbs. Let us not forget. That is the goal of wisdom. According to one early Christian leader who wrote a book called 1 Corinthians, that's in our New Testament, the pinnacle of God's wisdom is seen in God crucified on a cross. That's what he calls God's wisdom. That's the pinnacle of God's wisdom. That's what God looks like. That's what wisdom looks like. God has entered. This is the staggering thing we confess, that God has entered into our darkness, into our corruption, into our death, the things that we carry around with us that make us dread and terror and say, I have no place in this world, and God has made them his own. God has, oh, I just jump up and down. If we actually believe this, if we would actually believe this, this is good news. That's out of his love for us, God has done this. This is what God is like. This is how God uses all his infinite power in the universe. He loves. He loves before we do anything. Jesus is the place where every fear that we could ever have of anything vanishes. Jesus is the place where every fear that we could ever have of anything vanishes. Jesus is the place where we find joy and freedom and peace. And if that's not a better way of living, I don't know what is. According to another Christian leader, John this time, he says that there is no fear in love. There's no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. The only person who stays in fear, I do believe, is the person who refuses to receive this love, who refuses to believe it, who refuses to accept it, who refuses to be embraced by it. God is the kind of God who banishes darkness. And the only person that I can imagine being afraid of this kind of God, remaining in fear of this kind of God, is the kind of person who wants to stay, who is hell-bent, literally, hell-bent on staying in darkness, on staying in their darkness. That's the only kind of person I can imagine who would stay in fear of this God. If we were to put it in the language of Proverbs, this might be a takeaway. Well, I commented to Joy today that my takeaways from sermons today sound like Proverbs. They sound like riddles that we have to kind of unpack a little bit. So you might want to write this down, because I think it's true as I've been reflecting on it. If we were to put it in the language of Proverbs, the wise start with the fear of the Lord, but only the fool remains in fear of the Lord. The wise start in fear of the Lord, but only the fool stays in fear of the Lord. The invitation of Proverbs, the invitation, continual invitation of God himself throughout our lives is that we wouldn't be fools, that we wouldn't be fools, that we would learn to live the best possible kind of life right now before him. And the beauty of the opening of Proverbs in light of Jesus is that the fear of the Lord banishes all fear. The fear of the Lord banishes all fear, especially our fear of God. The fear of the Lord banishes all fear, especially our fear of God. God wants us to stand in awe and respect and reverence of him and his cross so that we will begin to recognize his never-ending love for us. That's why he wants us to stand in reverence. That's why he wants the fear of the Lord, reverence and awe, is so that we'll recognize his never-ending love for us. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but it's not. It leads us to the pinnacle of wisdom. The fear of the Lord leads us to the love of the Lord. Fear of the Lord leads us to the love of the Lord. We're invited to fear the Lord so that the Lord can drive out all fear. We're invited to fear the Lord so that the Lord can drive out all fear. And that leads us to this table. You guys can come on up if you want. Leads us to this table. This table is the place that we come each week communally. We come as a community together, and we also come personally. And we're saying, I want your life, my Lord and my God. I want your life. I believe that you are like this. I believe you're like this, body broken, blood poured out, and I want to receive your love. I want to believe your love so that you can keep reordering my life so that I can live a kind of life that is without fear. It's the place where we come in reverence and awe a little bit so that we confess that this is what the Lord is like. It's the place where all fear is driven out by love. As we think about what this bread and this juice mean, what these bread and this juice actually mean, it's the place where we remember that the Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it, saying, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." In just a couple minutes, you're going to be invited to come and receive from this table. You're going to be invited to come down the center and receive a bit of bread. That's what we're learning to do. We're learning to receive. All of our lives, we're learning to just receive from the hand of God. And that's what we practice this each week. You're invited to take some bread, to receive some bread, to dip it in the cup, and then to return to your seats along the sides. But as we come this morning, consider what this table means. Consider our posture before God as we're coming to the table this morning. What's the posture of your soul as you're coming to this table this morning? Do you want instruction? Do you want your life to be guided? Do you want your life to be reordered? Or are you just fine? I'll stay as I am. I'm pretty good. Thank you very much. This table is open. It's open to anyone who wants wisdom. to anyone who wants wisdom. As we receive, every week as we receive this bread and we dip it in a cup, what we're doing is we're embodying a prayer together. That's what you're doing when you come to this table. We're embodying a prayer with our actions. We're confessing our faith in the love represented in this table, and we're learning to receive a new kind of life. That's what we're praying as we come to this table. We're inviting God to reorder and cleanse and transform us so that we can stand in the light and live without fear. So as we approach the table this morning, God, may you give us the courage to search ourselves, and may we search our lives from top to bottom and discover that we are desperate lack of life. May we do that this morning. May we come to Jesus, Lord, in fear and trembling, and discover the love, your love that never, ever fails. And may we invite this love to reorder and remake our lives so that we can learn to live full of wisdom and without fear.